denied the motion without a hearing by filing a brief written order. Senate saw no reason for the judge to call attention to the case by holding a public session. Stan was worried that Wunsch and Malatesta were somehow on to Robbie. Favor shrugged it off. Silvio, he said, never made sense. McManus's concerns were more practical. He'd never been to court as a lawyer. Undoubtedly, during his years as an agent, he'd testified, but he'd never had to argue to a judge, and he betrayed the first nervousness even had seen from him. The day of the hearing, Robbie stopped briefly in Jim's office to strap on the recording equipment and to sign the consent forms. Because the Foxbite's batteries might run out during a lengthy wait in the courtroom, even would carry the remote and activate the recorder there. McManus was noticeably taciturn. Robbie assured him that the worse he looked, the better it would be under the circumstances, but McManus seemed too taut to take much comfort from the jest. He had on a blue church suit and a white shirt, and his hair, usually slightly astray, was gelled in place like a helmet. Even and Robbie set out for the courthouse separately from Jim. Favor today was fully relaxed. In fact, as he was about to enter the elevator in the temple's vast rotunda, something caught his attention, and he jumped out, marching to the sundries counter across the way. He addressed the blind proprietor by name. Leo! The man was elderly, close to 70, and stout. His striped cane hung from a hook beside the rear displays of cigarettes and aspirin and newspapers. He wore a starched white shirt, buttoned at the collar without a tie, but he was poorly shaven. His dark glasses, for some reason, had been laid next to his register, and he faced forward with his still, milky eyes. Leo and Favor exchanged sad remarks about the trappers, a never-ending lament now renewed with spring training imminent. As they spoke, Robbie picked up two packs of gum from one of the counter racks.
"What do you got there?" asked the old man.
"One pack of spearmint."
"One? Sounded like you took the whole damn display."
"Just one, Leo." Robbie turned to Even and winked as he showed her both packages. She was too appalled to speak. Favor again insisted that one pack was all he'd taken. Then he withdrew his alligator billfold from his pants pocket and laid a $100 bill in the plastic dish resting on the glass counter. There was a photo molded into the contours of the tray of a carefree young woman and the logo of Cool Cigarettes. The old man picked up the bill and fingered it carefully. He rubbed at a corner a long time, rolling it between his index finger and thumb.
"What is this?"
"It's a one, Leo."
"You got yourself stuck on one today. I ask you how many in a dozen, you gonna say one?"
"It's a one, man."
"Uh-huh. I know you, Robbie."
"I swear to you, Leo, there's a number one right on it." His voice barely contained his laughter. He was having so much fun. "Only don't put it in the drawer with the ones. Put it underneath, in the bottom of the register. It's a special one."
"Yeah, special."
The old man made a tiny tear in one corner and lifted the cash drawer. He dropped four dimes and a penny in the tray on the counter, and Robbie scooped them up.
"You gotta stop doing this, Robbie."
"No, I don't, Leo. I got no reason to stop. I'll see you next week." He grabbed the old man's spotted hand to draw him forward, then kissed him squarely atop his glistening bald scalp. As Robbie walked back toward the elevator, he explained to Even that Leo was his father's first cousin. "He was my dad's best friend as a kid. He went blind at 13 from the measles, but my old man stuck by him. Even after my dad took off, my ma always gave him credit for that."
"He didn't turn his back on Leo, your father, I'll say that much. He didn't forget his cousin."
Even had heard Robbie's mother's voice emerging from the speakerphone in his office, and her son had caught the old lady's inflection precisely. Even had to laugh, and Robbie laughed himself once she did. My ma used to invite Leo around. You know, I'd find them sitting there having tea when I got home from school, laughing like a couple of old guys in a tavern. I loved to see him. Leo can be a real card. And he told me stories about my dad. Nice stories, you know? Nice for a kid to hear. How they used to run from evil-eyed Flavin, or flatten pennies on the railroad tracks, or play ball. I'd see him sitting there with my ma, and naturally I'd think what a kid would think, you know? Wishing that it was my father instead. He looked down the hallway, wistfully. The elevators dinged, and the smell of bacon drifted from the cafeteria. And you know who got him this stand here? Robbie asked. You? Well, I mean, I asked for him, but I'm Dick. I asked them to hold the elevator around here. They don't even do that. You know who I went to? You know who listened to Leo's whole sad story and arranged it with Judge Mumphrey and the committee men and all the other heavyweights who had to have their rings kissed? Can you guess? She couldn't. Brendan Toohey. Yeah, Brendan. He made a sound then, and another sad face. With no other recourse, she suddenly tapped her watch. Robbie had forgotten. Shit, he said, and scowled, despairing momentarily over everything. In his hand, he noticed the packages of chewing gum and handed them to Even. He tapped his jaw. Bridge work, he said, and entered the elevator as it arrived. Like the rest of the temple, Judge Malatesta's courtroom had a leaden, functional air. There were straight-backed pews of yellowing birch and a matching installation of squared-off benchwork at the front for the court officers. The witness stand stood lower than the judge's bench to which it was joined. The court reporter and clerk had desks immediately before the judge, and the lawyer's podium was centered yet another yard or so ahead. Everything was square. The great seal of the state hung behind the judge between two flags on standards. On the west wall across from the windows hung a gilt-framed portrait of the late county executive Augustine Bolcaro, referred to by everyone as the mayor. Malatesta's call was already in progress. Lawyers bustled in and out with their briefcases and topcoats in their arms. Jim entered by himself and sat stiffly on the opposite side of the room, waiting for the case to be called. He was careful not to look in their direction, nibbling absent-mindedly on his lips now and then. Walter, in his heavy suit, was at his crowded desk in front of the bench. He called each case and exchanged papers with the judge, receiving the ones from the concluded matter as he handed up the briefs and orders Malatesta would need next. He, too, acted as if he had not noticed them, which Even did not take as an especially welcome sign. Sennett's fretting about the hearing had affected her. If for some reason Malatesta ruled for McManus today, the whole project was going to be in trouble. It would be hard to explain in D.C. or anywhere else why their fixer had failed. This was the first concrete test to see if Robbie Favor was more than hot air. Petros v. Standard Railing 93 CL-140, Walter finally called out lethargically after they'd been there nearly half an hour. Even reached into her briefcase and clicked the remote for the foxbite. From the birch podium, Robbie and McManus identified themselves for the court reporter, a young black woman who took the information down without glancing up at either of them. Even followed Robbie up and stood, as she'd been instructed, a few feet behind him. McManus had carried several pages of inked notes on yellow foolscap to the podium with him. At near range, Silvio Malatesta did not really look to Even like a crook. That was not surprising. Crooks often didn't run to type. Con men all had a self-impressed air. But bank robbers, on the other hand, seemed to come from any direction. Plenty of gang toughs and thugs, but often the guy next door. Public corruption cases, they said, were the same, enmeshing plenty of obvious hustlers, but often the seemingly trustworthy. Malatesta fit in the latter category. He appeared pleasantly avuncular, with thinning grayish hair and heavy black-framed glasses, his small, quick eyes swimming within the distortions. Even in the robe he looked slightly too thin for his clothing, his shirt gaping at the neck. He licked his lips before speaking in his mildly officious tone, a bit like a clergyman's.
"Well," he said, and smiled at the lawyers, "this is a very interesting matter. Very interesting. The papers here are very well drawn on each side. Both parties have had the advantage of top-rate advocacy. Now, counsel for Standard Railing, McCann?"
Jim repeated his name.
"Mr. McManus makes the appealing argument that a person ought not to be allowed to drink himself to the point of senselessness and then blame someone else for the mishaps that follow. Mr. Favor counters that Standard's position is a bit of a red herring. Balcony railings, he says, must be built of a sufficient height and durability to prevent a fall, whether the plaintiff stumbles because he's deliberately tripped by an usher, or gets caught up in his own feet, or keels over drunk. In Mr. Favor's view, a railing is like a lawnmower or a pharmaceutical drug, where the manufacturer is strictly liable for any injuries that result from the use of the product. The cases in other jurisdictions admittedly go in both directions."
With a sudden manifestation of his usual irritable look, Walter rose up from his desk and interrupted the judge. The bench was at eye height for him, and he was on his toes, reaching over it like a window ledge to point out a paper he'd handed the judge before. Malatesta was evidently confused, and he covered the microphone for the courtroom's public address system with his palm as Walter spoke to him. He was smiling faintly when he resumed.
"Well," he said, "I had intended to hear argument, but the calendar is crowded, and Mr. Wunsch reminds me that in light of that, I signed and filed an order last night denying Mr. McManus's motion to dismiss. So, no need to do again what's already done. That will be the ruling of the court, with due apology to counsel. The case will proceed."
Malatesta emitted another somewhat tentative smile and directed Walter to set a date for a status. In the brief hush, the only sounds were the heat from a register below the podium and Walter's pen scratching out an order to confirm what the judge had said.
"But, Your Honor," said McManus suddenly. Robbie's head shot around. McManus was sagged over the podium with a forlorn expression. Before he could say more, Favor thanked the judge, and as he wheeled, kicked Jim in the ankle while he steered Even out by the elbow. Glancing back, she saw McManus slowly gathering his papers. Klecker had stopped the foxbite and removed it from Favor by the time Jim returned to the conference room from the courthouse.
"But, Your Honor,"
screamed Robbie as soon as he saw Jim. McManus was too low-key and measured to be vulnerable to ribbing very often, and Robbie made the most of the opportunity.
"What were you going to do?" Robbie shouted. "Try to talk the judge into changing his mind?"
Caught somewhere between sheepishness and amusement, McManus sat in one of the conference room barrel chairs. His tie was lowered and he appeared drained by the entire experience. "It had been such a confusing moment," he finally said. After all the preparation, his instinct was to react like any other loser. McManus's brief protest in the courtroom actually amounted to good cover, which made it that much easier for Robbie to give him the business. Even and Klecker hailed several other agents in from the hallway to listen.
"You're the patsy,"
Favor screamed.
"You're supposed to lose."
Both Senate and I had arrived while Robbie was carrying on. Klecker had downloaded the recording magazine to the computer equipment in the cabinet and replayed for us the brief exchange in the courtroom. Listening, McManus shook his head and said he remained utterly lost about what Malatesta had been up to. He couldn't understand then or now why the judge would schedule a hearing only to announce he'd reached a decision last night. But Sennett, running at warp speed, saw what had happened.
"That's a snow job for the record," he answered Jim. "It's wallpaper for the derriere. This guy is really clever," he said. "There's going to be a perfect excuse for everything. The motion's a close call, so Malatesta staged the hearing to show he had so little interest in who won or who lost that he even forgot he'd already ruled. If anybody ever questions him on the case, today's transcript will be Exhibit A for the defense. We can't drop a stitch, or Malatesta will go right through the opening."
A second of hushed admiration for Stan's deft intelligence penetrated the still air of the conference room. For the agents, perhaps, it had never been quite as clear why Sennett was in charge. He held the floor an instant longer, the smallest man there, looking about, impressing his warnings and his discipline on each of them. Chapter 11. For all his over-enthusiastic openness about everything else, Robbie was guarded concerning Lorraine. At the start, he said next to nothing to Evan concerning his wife, as if to emphasize that notwithstanding his deal with the government, in this arena they could not intrude. But after 6 weeks around him, Evan had absorbed a lot about Rainey and her illness. She'd learned bits from Mort or the staff, and coming and going from Robbie's office, she'd overheard dozens of his cheerful phone calls with his wife, as well as more sober conversations with the legion of caretakers in Rainey's life, doctors, physical therapists, occupational therapists, masseuses, nurses, and the home health care aide whom he employed 24 hours a day. By now, he'd even ventured isolated observations to Evan about Rainey, but only a sentence or two, rather than his usual extended digressions. Recently, he'd glumly reported on the need to puree everything Lorraine ate. "Puree of steak, can you imagine? Pureed muffin. She can still taste, at least." His lean face took on the longing, distant look of a man at sea. It was something of a surprise one day in mid-February when he invited Evan in to meet Lorraine. They had been in the neighborhood, down the block, in fact, meeting a prospective client. Sarah Perlin, a short and portly woman, wanted to sue the local tennis center for the Achilles tendon she'd torn when she'd stumbled on a wayward ball. When they were done at Sarah's, Robbie had suggested a visit with Lorraine. Evan was reluctant to intrude, but he insisted Rainey wanted to meet his new paralegal.
"I guess I've talked a lot about you."
His furry brows crawled up his forehead as if this phenomenon struck him as unaccountable. From the entry, you could imagine the interior as it had once been. Something of a neat freak, Rainey Favor had tended to the austere and had furnished almost exclusively in white. The living room, as Robbie had once observed, was the sort of place where a 3-year-old with a chocolate bar could do as much damage as a tornado. But sickness had a design sense of its own. Outside the house, Robbie referred to it as the Disease Museum, a proving ground and display space for every device, simple or complex, that might somehow improve the life Lorraine had left. Along the handcrafted walnut railing that ran up the turret staircase dominating the foyer, an electric hoist now whirred along a grease-blackened track. Metal hospital rails had been applied to all the walls, and there were a number of electronic doorbells visible that Rainey had once used to summon help. On the first step of the staircase, he turned to Evan. "Sure you can handle this?" He might have thought of that before, but it was too late to turn around. The truth was that she was not good with illness. Mawmaw, her grandmother, paralyzed after disc surgery went bad, had moved in with her parents when Evan was 15. Her entire existence by then was founded on physical well-being, and she was often frightened in the presence of the old woman, even sickened when a sheet or hem slipped away and she caught sight of her grandmother's legs wasted to the width of a hockey stick. She kept what distance she could. "You know, it isn't catching," her mother finally told her one afternoon in her customarily brutal fashion. This encounter could be worse. Mama's decline had been long but natural. Rainy Favor was 38 years old and dying. There was really no hope. Some, a distinct minority of ALS patients, lived 20 years with the disease as it smoldered through their bodies. Stephen Hawking was by far the most famous of these slow-progressing cases. But Lorraine was normal, walking one day, falling down the next, and in a wheelchair within 18 months. Her hands had weakened to the point that she could no longer hold a pencil or lift her arms above her head. And now, 2.5 years after diagnosis, she could not feed herself or swallow well. She needed assistance even to remain upright on the toilet. She could not control her salivary glands, and shortly before Evan had arrived on the scene, they had been irradiated to keep Rainey from drowning in her own spit. There were no prize winners for the worst disease, Robbie had told Evan. He knew this from his practice. The body could fall apart in gruesome ways not even envisioned in nightmares. But this one, this rotten motherfucker of a disease, as he repeatedly called it, was perhaps the most insidious. Your body deserted you. The voluntary muscles weakened, spasmed painfully, and then stopped working at all. Even the minutest volitional reflexes eventually disappeared, blinking usually being the last to go, rendering a patient entirely inert. In the meantime, intellectual functions remained unimpaired. Rainey thought. She saw. And worst of all, Robbie said, she felt. Inside and out, movement ended with ALS, but not pain. She suffered intensely and could not writhe or lift her hand far enough to massage the muscles knotted in misery. The Favors had tried every potential remedy, herbalists and homeopaths and acupuncture. They'd volunteered for experimental drugs and had been accepted for one trial, a medicine that after 90 days left Rainey on the same steady downward slide. They had even gone to see a woman with a ridiculous machine made up of old vacuum tubes and a long flashing neon wand that she waved over Rainey's torso while making a woo-woo noise with her mouth. The scene, Robbie said, would have been worth a laugh had they not been so humiliated, faced with the unreasoning depths of their desperation. The Favors' bedroom, where Robbie still slept, was full of contraptions. Evan crept to the threshold, but went no farther, inasmuch as Rainey was in the bathroom. In her absence, Robbie toured the room, pointing out various machines he'd previously described. There was something called a Hoyer lift that brought Lorraine, when she had the energy, from the large hospital bed to her wheelchair. An adjustable tray table held a speakerphone, the Easy Writer, an appliance to hold a pencil, a mechanical page turner for reading, and two remote controls for the huge theater-style TV. A glowing computer monitor sat beside the bed, along with an alphabet board on which Rainey pointed out letters when she became frustrated by her efforts to speak. All of this, of course, had cost monumentally. Including the caregiver's fees, the figure she'd heard Robbie repeat was more than $2 million. He would soon blow through the lifetime cap on his insurance and already had a suit pending against the company for several $100,000 in covered expenses they'd refused to pay. But in a situation with few blessings, money was one. He had money, buckets of money, 100 times the resources of most families whom this disease routinely brought to the verge of bankruptcy. In their case, Mort had told Evan once, Rainey simply would not live long enough for Robbie to spend everything. The process of retrieving Lorraine from the bathroom was underway. Even retreated while Robbie assisted the aide, a tiny Filipina named Elba. Down the hall, Even heard them encouraging Rainey as she was restored to the chair and wheeled back. The night before, a Sunday, Robbie had gone to a wedding. Rainey had been too fatigued to go, but having promised to take his mother, Robbie attended, ferrying the old woman back and forth from the nursing home where she lived. Rainey slept in snatches between bouts of muscle cramps and had apparently missed his return last night as well as his departure this morning. Robbie described the evening's doings now.
Mother of all Jewish weddings, right down to the sculpted chopped liver. Great food, bad wine. And even so, my Uncle Harry was drunk like always and got so sick he didn't notice that he'd flushed his false teeth down the john.
Much more softly, Rainey answered. Her faint, mumbling speech, a wobbly, ghoulish drone with a glottal hiccup at the end of every word, was growing worse every day. For this, too, Robbie envisioned mechanical aid, a computer-controlled voice simulator that could be operated so long as Rainey had any voluntary movement remaining, even flexing her brow. Even had heard Robbie's discussions with his wife's former colleagues in the computer industry who were helping. The hardware had been purchased and stored somewhere in the house, but the favors held out against each of these changes as long as possible, since no matter how convenient they were, there was no way to avoid the emotional impact of the lengthening shadow of decline.
"To the nines," he answered now. "Everybody. Inez bought a $3,000 dress. Where she gets $3,000 for a dress is beyond me, and as soon as she walks in, there's Susan Schultz in the same thing. Then my Aunt Myrna shows up in this tight white number, a lady of, what, 60? And through the fabric and her pantyhose, you can see the outline of the tattoo on her fanny. You don't pick your family, right? I took my ma out on the dance floor in her wheelchair and whirled her around a few times. She got a real bang out of it."
Even heard Rainey's voice again. "I wish you'd been there too," he said more somberly. He refused to linger on the downbeat. Whatever his private moods, with Lorraine, Robbie was determined to be the spirit of brave optimism. On the phone, Even had often heard him counterpoint his wife's reports of deterioration by reminding her of some other physical element that seemed to be withstanding the physician's dire predictions. Frequently, he'd turned to the computer in his office to tap out a message to her, especially when he'd heard a good joke. "Email," he explained to Even, an innovation to which Lorraine had introduced him. Now his tone ascended cheerily as he announced Even. She girded herself. A blast of air freshener could not fully conceal the many odors that shrank the large room. Excretory smells, liniments and lotions, cramped body scents, the greasy effluvium of machines. As Even entered, Robbie was massaging Rainey's arm to alleviate a spasm. She was in her wheelchair, the High Rider, a huge, impressive, motor-driven affair with elaborate padding and smaller wheels. Robbie had described the chair. It not only moved smoothly in every direction from a joystick control, but rose to a standing position, so that once she was strapped in, Lorraine could even greet guests at the door. Tonight she simply sat, held upright by two belts across her waist and chest. She wore a high-fashion running suit, on which the zippers had been replaced with Velcro. From the corner of her mouth, a crooked tube protruded, attached to a bottle of distilled water on an IV standard, which provided a steady drip to replace her saliva. Even behind this obstruction, Rainey Favor's beauty had not fully deserted her, although she looked decades older than the woman in the photo behind Robbie's desk. The muscle waist had emaciated her and left her head canted slightly to the left, but she apparently asked her attendant for makeup every day, and her dark hair retained its luster. Somewhat caved in, her face was still striking. The remarkable violet eyes of the photograph remained vivid and fully focused on Even as she approached. Hopelessly ill at ease, Even did her best. She'd heard so much about Rainey. Robbie was proud of her courage. Lorraine considered that and slowly worked her mouth around several words. Her lips had lost most of their elasticity and barely responded.
"Rough to be you?"
It made no sense, and Even had to turn to Robbie for help.
"Lovely to meet you," Robbie translated.
He explained that certain letters had grown impossible, L's especially. He smiled at his wife and touched her hand. She always called herself a Jap.
"Rame joke,"
Rainey said with protracted effort. Even laughed with Elba and Robbie, but despite all warnings, Lorraine's acuity was jolting. A dismal register of the vast inventory of thoughts and feelings even now going unvoiced. The laughter, which had rippled through Rainey like a light current, led to a spell of coughing. This reflex, too, was weakened, and in order to clear Lorraine's air passages, little Elba bolstered Rainey and applied a cupped hand repeatedly against her back, speaking sweetly in her sharply accented voice. When Lorraine recovered, she resumed where she had left off. The interruption was unnoted. Life was what could be grasped in the intervals. She asked Even about work. How long? Where from? She mustered only two-word questions. Robbie hovered over the chair and mediated. Even this woman in extremis, Even answered in her undercover identity. Robbie, who had shared nothing of his own situation with Rainey, would have wanted nothing else.
"What if?" asked Rainey. "Bye."
She was asking if Even lived nearby, apparently curious about why Even was here in the dwindling hours of the afternoon. Robbie explained their meeting with Sarah Perlin and said that he was going to have to drive Even back to her place. Something struck him as he spoke, a wayward implication in the detail, and Rainey responded at once to his apparent anxiety. In the faltering moment in which Robbie vamped to cover, explaining that Even was new to town and still without a car, a different air came into the room. Rainey Favor had heard her share of tales from her husband, especially regarding other women, and she clearly knew she was hearing one now. Her narrow, long-jawed face could show little in the way of expression, but even at that, her eyelids fluttered in a labored way, and her lovely eyes grew darker.
"Come here,"
she told Even. Even pitched a look at Robbie, but his doting manner with his wife apparently comprehended no way to deny her. He let Even take his place beside the chair. She bent closer because she could not hear when Rainey first spoke.
"He rise."
It took a moment. Great, Even thought when she understood. Perfect for the government witness, a testimonial to his dishonesty from the person who knew him best. Rainey, after a moment of recovery, had more.
"He rise about everything,"
she said.
"Remember."
Even suddenly understood that she was receiving a warning, vengeful in part, but also perhaps shared in a sisterly spirit. Robbie was not to be believed. If he said he cared, pay no attention. If he said he'd marry her when Lorraine was gone, it was only another lie. Rainey's eyes bore in as her message fired home. Robbie intervened to save Even. "She already knows that, sweetie. Everybody who hangs around me for a while knows that." Back beside the chair, Robbie was alone in smiling at his joke. "It'll just take her a few years to see my good side."
"Yes,"
said Rainey.
Years, she meant, and went on deliberately in her watery monotone.
Then I be dead, and you be happy.
Robbie took quite a while with that. His tongue was laid inside his cheek. He gave her a look, a dignified request.
Don't talk that way.
But he said nothing. He bent to adjust Rainey's legs on pieces of foam cut to cushion them, and still without a word, turned to take Even back to the city. In the car, after some time, he said,
They say things. Pals. People with ALS. It's part of the disease, because of the neurons that get affected in the brainstem. They lose impulse control. It's actually funny in a way. You know, ironic. Lorraine was always one of those people who couldn't say anything. It just built up. She burned holes in my suits. She threw my Cubans down the toilet. She once put cayenne pepper in my jockstrap. You can imagine what that was about.
A brief smile flickered up in admiration of his wife's spunk.
But she couldn't say what was on her mind. Now, criminy. God, what I've heard.
Facing him, Even had no idea what to say. Her sense of the size of what was bearing down on Rainey and Robbie was still gathering. The whole episode had left her heart feeling as if it wanted to scurry around her chest. The car slid to the curb beside the brown awning extending from her building. Pedestrians rushed beneath it along the refurbished brick walks in their hats and heavy coats, eager to reach the warmth of their homes. She still knew none of her neighbors. There was an insular mood to the area. Despite extensive renovation and renewal, bums and addicts could often be found in the mornings asleep in the sandblasted doorways or beside the struggling saplings in their fancy wooden planter boxes. Local residents were in the habit of moving on with their business without greeting anyone. She reached for the door handle, then looked Favor's way. Somehow, after all her ungainliness, she managed something in her expression. In response, 100 emotions seemed to swim through his face.
You know what a Yahrzeit candle is? He asked her then.
She didn't.
It's what Jews do to commemorate a death in the family. Mother, brother. Every year you light this candle on the anniversary. And it's the saddest goddamn thing. This candle burns for 24 hours in like a water glass. And even if you get up in the middle of the night, the thing is flickering. The only light in the house. My ma always lit one for her sister. And right before her stroke, I was there, you know. I'd go see her early in the morning. It was still dark. And I looked at this thing sitting on the stove, this forlorn kind of light, spurting and wavering, charring the sides of the glass and getting lower all the time. And I suddenly said to myself, that's Rainey. That's what she is now. Just a long, sad candle melting, burning down to this soft puddle of stuff, which will finally drown the light. That's Rainey.
He drooped against the wooden steering wheel. She waited what seemed to be forever, but he never looked her way. Instead, she left the car and watched as he zoomed from the curb and executed a smooth U-turn despite the heavy traffic, speeding back toward home. Chapter 12. UCork's protocols aimed at avoiding trials in the contrived cases. A full courtroom showdown with witnesses for two sides would require both the manpower and the budget of a Hollywood production and would greatly enhance the risks of detection. Plan A was that Robbie would either win a motion that disposed of a whole case or prevail on some other significant ruling, then declare the matter favorably settled and make a payoff. Thus, Judge Malatesta's denial of McManus's motion to dismiss set the stage for Robbie to make his first recorded drop, this one to Walter Wunsch.
With that, the project would move beyond what the agents called talking dirty to real criminality. Assuming no foul-ups, Walter would become the first trophy, the first dead-bang conviction, and the first person to squeeze when Stan began the ultimate castle siege meant to bring down Brendan Toohey. About 2 weeks after the session in Malatesta's courtroom, Robbie phoned Walter, imparting the good news that the judge's ruling had forced McManus to settle Petros v. Standard Railing and arranging the drop at their customary site, the parking garage adjoining the temple. That afternoon, Klecker arrived at McManus's with another of his clever devices, a portable video camera with a fiber-optic lens that fit into the hinge of a dummy briefcase matching Robbie's. McManus looked it over, then quickly vetoed its use. Robbie's never passed money before wearing hardware. It's tough enough to keep up the cover without worrying about aiming and focusing. We'll use the camera later.
Jim, argued Sennett in obvious distress. Jim, a jury will want to see the money change hands. If it's only audio and Robbie can't get Walter to say something about the dough, this whole thing won't be worth much.
Jim would not budge. He rarely asserted the authority that UCORC had given him over operational details. In theory, Stan determined what evidence was needed, and Jim made the tactical decisions about how to obtain it. But usually, Jim let Stan have his way. The best Stan could manage now was cool courtesy to hide the fact he was bridling. Instead, the discussion turned to how Robbie could make an overt reference to the money, something which this dark world's strict etiquette severely discouraged. Favor came up with the idea of delivering $15,000 to Walter instead of the usual $10,000. The rationale for this largesse was found, oddly, in a problem that had been irritating Sennett for several days. By now, Sennett had ground out 6 more fictitious complaints. To Stan and McManus's amazement and chagrin, half of the new cases had been drawn to Malatesta, while none went to Barnett Skolnick. Sennett was especially eager to get to Skolnick, the one judge who dealt with Favor without a bagman. But Robbie had no reason to complain about the assignments. His only interest was supposed to be having the case before a judge he could talk to. However, with 3 specials recently added to Malatesta's calendar, Favor had need to be particularly ingratiating, and the additional sum would provide an excuse to address the amount of money Robbie was bringing Walter. But this left the agents $5,000 short. With some anguish, McManus wrote a check to cash on the law office's account, knowing it would require hours of paperwork for D.C., only to find the bank downstairs closed when he arrived. Ultimately, Sennett had to make a series of calls. The United States attorney returned half an hour later and drew $5,000 in cash from an envelope in his topcoat. He'd requisitioned the funds with his own IOU from the Drug Enforcement Administration, which kept tens of thousands of dollars in currency on hand as buy money. Every bill was then photocopied so it could be identified if it turned up in a search. The stack of almost 200 bills, mostly hundreds and fifties with a sprinkling of twenties, was nearly an inch thick, even banded. Accordingly, Robbie's habit with Walter was to deliver the cash in a cigarette carton. Wunsch was a heavy smoker, one of those nicotine fugitives regularly pacing back and forth before the temple, coatless no matter what the weather, and looking as if he was attempting to suck the cigarette dry in his race to get back to the courtroom before the judge returned to the bench. Finally, Robbie was wired. He let his trousers down this time without much forethought. Afterwards, Robbie grabbed the cigarette carton with the money and even also put on her coat. She would be in the car while Robbie and Walter met. It would be far too unsettling to Wunsch if Favor handed over the money in front of her. But the need to overcome standard courtroom defenses meant she had to catch sight of Wunsch to confirm it was his voice on the recording. She also had to watch Robbie so she could testify at trial that he'd had no opportunity to keep the money himself. To corroborate the drop, McManus would frisk Fever carefully as soon as he returned.
"Now you have the scenario?" Sennett asked, reminding Robbie yet again to talk about the money. "And see if you can find out what the hell Malatesta does with all this cash.
The service," he said, meaning the IRS, "can't see anything."
That remark appeared to prick McManus, who looked up abruptly.
Interagency rivalries are fierce, and Jim apparently knew little about the IRS's continuing participation in the investigation, although he must have anticipated as much. In a world where catching bad guys gives life meaning, the IRS agents who'd knocked on Robbie's door would never settle for being entirely cut out of the case. Nevertheless, knowing Sennett, I suspected Stan was putting Jim in his place, reminding him who still held the most secrets in the game of need to know. Given the significance of the first payoff, Stan wanted to listen as it was made, which meant that I too was invited to join McManus and Klecker in the back of the surveillance van. We each walked separately to the new federal building, where a guard cleared us to enter the garage in the basement. The van was a boxy gray Aerostar with flashy ivory detailing on the side. The only light in the rear came from two frosted observation bubbles on either side of the vehicle, which provided a dim, wide-angle vantage on the passing world. Cables snaked all over, and Klecker knelt on the rubber floor mats, hovering close to the readouts and dials of the banks of electrical equipment secured with steel belts bolted to the floor. The stale air had a strong, rubbery smell. As we left the garage, Sennett, McManus, and I were seated on narrow fold-down seats hinged to the wall, under strict instructions to stay there and be quiet, so that we did not impede the work of the agents. The van was driven by Joe Amari, a middle-aged FBI veteran who'd clearly worked with Jim before, and who posed as the law office's investigator. Joe had coppery Sicilian skin and black hair so thick and perfectly groomed that it looked like something from a furrier's shelf. He had the appearance of a squat, tough guy, and he was. He'd been under a dozen times, almost always on mob cases. The municipal parking structure adjoining the courthouse was a five-tier, open-air affair, built in the same buff-colored brick as the temple. By plan, Wunsch, in an old Chesterfield topcoat, would already be lurking on the ground floor. Robbie would drive by him with no sign of recognition, racing up the circling lanes to the top floor, which at this hour was largely deserted. In time, we heard the Mercedes gear shift jammed into park and Robbie's tread as he crossed to the elevator. If all went according to the standard arrangement, when the elevator's brown doors rumbled back, Wunsch would be inside. Robbie and Walter had been using the elevator for drops for years now. The tiny carriage was a squeeze even for four persons and a hopeless wreck. The tiled flooring was gone in most places, and the elevator reeked from its use as a pissoir by various urban vagabonds. The contraption rose and descended at an infinitesimal pace, and with awful sounds, the cables squealing and the brakes clanging like steam pipes whenever the machine slowed to an actual halt. It was used by virtually no one, particularly on the way down. Robbie was speaking even before the doors labored to a close.
"Jesus, Wally, the old man had me wetting my socks with that Hamlet routine up there. I wrote him a great brief. What else was he looking for, smoke signals?"
"Shit. Silvio, half the time he don't know if it's today or tomorrow. And besides, you could give the old fuck a heart attack if you said reversed on appeal. Any chance the boys upstairs will bounce a case back gives him the willies. He figures somebody somewhere is keeping track."
A reversal on appeal would draw suspicion to a case. Malatesta, as Stan had deduced, was determined to eliminate even the remotest risks of discovery.
"Believe me, I had to carry on with him a long time on this one. I deserved the freaking Oscar. I had to wipe his nose and diaper his behind before he did the right thing. Anyway," Walter concluded in a tone meant to get down to business,
"Robbie said he'd brought some smokes." The sound of the cardboard ripping was distinct.
Yeah, said Walter in time. That's the right brand, okay.
15 long there.
Mm-hmm, Walter answered quietly.
Because I want the old man to remember I'm a righteous fella. You're going to be seeing a lot of me.
Robbie reminded Wunsch of the 3 new cases. Walter, predictably, was more ornery than grateful.
This better not be the miracle of the month club, he answered, because after this one, Silvio's neck's back in his shell for a long while.
This wasn't a miracle. I had great authorities.
Shit, Walter answered. That wasn't what I was hearing. You better make sure Santa's got me right on top of his Christmas list. Santa better love me this year.
We'll write you down for a bushel on a peck and a hug around the neck.
Fuck.
No, here you go. Look at this.
The distinct crinkling of what I knew to be a travel brochure could be heard, along with the scuffing of fabric as Favor removed it from his pocket. Walter, like the other bagmen, expected a tip, but he preferred no cash. He had told Robbie that he had enough cash, a reference, presumably, to the share Malatesta provided from his end. More pertinently, over the years, Mrs. Wunsch had figured out where Walter was likely to hide his stash, and by his reports, regularly looted it. As a result, he preferred tangible items, and thought nothing of calling Robbie with requests for merchandise that had caught his eye. Robbie had it all shipped to Walter's country cottage, where his wife seldom visited. Recently, he'd been paying Wunsch's way to various golfing havens. He extolled the resort in Virginia portrayed in the brochure.
Yeah, well, I'll go, Walter said. But listen, since I had to carry your water so far uphill on this thing here, I had a thought. I've been looking at some irons, oversized graphite shafts. You seen these Berthas? Nice clubs.
With appropriate grumbling, Robbie now agreed to add the irons, then slid the conversation toward the topics Sennett wanted him to cover.
Listen, Wally, I gotta ask you one thing about the old man that's always bugged the hell out of me. I look at him up there on the bench. The guy dresses like a hobo.
From the sound of it, Walter enjoyed the description.
And whenever I see him tooling around the courthouse, he's in some old heap, right?
83 Chevy.
And he and the wife still live in his mom's old bungalow in Kewanee, right? Isn't that the story? So what gives? It makes me nuts wondering. Where's it going?
Over the speakers, there was a momentary lapse, during which the grinding motion of the elevator mechanism and the stiff wrinkling of the brochure going inside Walter's topcoat were audible. It was clear Wunsch did not welcome Robbie's curiosity.
Favor, this isn't a fucking game show. You think I ask questions? I don't care if he's using it in the outhouse. What's it to you? I can't make no sense of whatever's going on in Silvio's little noggin anyway.
Another silence followed, punctuated almost at once by the terrifying sound of the elevator brake being applied. The doors rumbled again as they retracted, followed by the scuffling of Walter's departure. Then there was an unexpected bouncing noise, and Walter's voice was heard once more. He had apparently thrown a hand between the rubber bumpers on the closing elevator doors. Across the van, McManus tensed, anxious about the meaning of Wunsch's return.
And listen, he said. They got a big demand on these clubs. They're on back order, okay? So you know to get 'em, you know, they gotta be ordered right now.
Gotcha, Robbie answered.
The doors finally closed, sealed off the sound of the city clamor heard in the background in the open-air garage. In the van, as we listened to the elevator creak, to Robbie padding back to the auto, to the engine rumbling to life, there was an immediate air of celebration. Walter Wunsch now had a confirmed reservation in a federal penitentiary, and he'd said enough damaging things about Malatesta that the recording would be useful, both in forcing Walter to turn on the judge and in corroborating him once he did it. Stan shot a thumb in the air and unfastened his seat belt so he could move around the van, hunched from the waist, shaking hands. I noticed he made it a point to start with Jim. Yet as Amari drove back, I felt somewhat
removed. I was happy enough to see the project succeed, but I was more stunned than I'd anticipated by the events. I'd always known there were monkey shines of some kind going on in the Kendall County Superior Court when I began practice as a new assistant state defender late in the 1960s. Zeb Mayall, a bail bondsman and ward boss, still sat in open view in the central branch courtroom, issuing instructions to everyone present, often including the judge. But in the felony courthouse on the other side of the canyon created by U.S. 843, I was always an outsider. I'd come to the law at my father's table, listening to him speak about the great principles of decisions, moments that remain in memory, magical and intense, like the spotlight's circle of white on a darkened stage. I didn't understand those who saw the law only as either a commodity or a social lubricant, nor, frankly, did they know what to make of me. I had no committee man, no parish to name, and was primly disdainful whenever someone suggested that I take steps, selling tickets, for example, to a fundraiser, to overcome these deficits. Over time, I realized that the system that existed, whatever it was, had as one of its principal aims closing out fellows like me, with my faint southern accent, my unfaltering manners, my Brooks Brothers apparel, and my Easton degree. I was someone who had prospects in the center city among the suits and the towers. Most of the regulars in the felony courthouse knew they counted for little in that realm, which was one of their foremost, if unspoken, excuses for taking care of each other. And eventually, as they expected, I departed for that other world, to the federal courts, where there was officiousness but virtually no known corruption, beyond what was suspected about a few rogue drug agents. Robbie's tales of retail justice were appalling, but also somehow titillating to me, because they suggested again some stifled secret I'd been searching for during my years across the highway. And now, in the banter between Robbie and Walter, I heard it. The hard wisdom of their clandestine world. A strange message was communicated in the passing of Cash. I know the worst about you. You know the worst about me. The claims of law, rules, the larger community, the fabled, phony distinctions of class, are all, in the end, as insubstantial as dreams. Palaver aside, the black truth, which only we dare speak and which, as a result, gives us insuperable power, is that we are all servants of selfish appetites. All of us. All.
Field hockey?
Yes, field hockey. It's been an Olympic sport longer than basketball.
I know. Really, I know that.
Guys get killed, right? In Pakistan? Somebody's always getting brained with that thing? The cudgel? The stick. Stick. It can be dangerous. She stopped and lifted her lip to show him where there was still a pink scar. His black eyes, silvered by the streetlights, shifted back and forth from the traffic. Now that he was past his initial surprise, he nodded gravely, almost slavishly, clearly hoping to forestall any dread on her part that she had finally told him. But she felt little regret. It was a good night. Neither of them was down yet from the thrill of getting Walter, and in truth, he'd guessed. About 2 weeks ago, he'd bought something called the Olympic Factbook, and once or twice on the ride to or from work, he'd toss an event at her, usually as a non sequitur. He'd started with archery and went right through the alphabet. He was cute about it, of course, making his determination a joke, putting on a poor-mouthing little boy look. This morning he'd gotten to fencing, and tonight he'd had no trouble reading her smile. She was revealing only a fraction of what would come out about her eventually, now that there was certain to be a prosecution, and he'd been right at the start. He was too good an actor to blow the cover.
"The Olympics," he said, in dazzled admiration.
Guys were always like this, staggered that a female had lived out their fantasies.
You probably couldn't even believe it was real.
Some would say it hadn't been. It was 84, so the Soviet bloc didn't show, but none of those teams were a power that year. So for her, the glow had been largely undiminished.
And you were great, right?
He asked. To make the Olympics, you had to be great.
Great?
There was too much heat in the car, and she was almost groggy. She had thought she was great. In high school, she was the best in Colorado, where no more than half the high schools even played. She was runner-up for Female Athlete of the Year in state and received a scholarship to Iowa, one of the great programs in the country, the absolute tops west of the Mississippi. She had gone off with high hopes. She was selected for the national senior team as a sophomore. It meant she was being groomed for the Olympics. But two of her teammates at Iowa were also on the squad, one a defender midfielder like her, and both of them better than she was. They were stars, bigger stars than even. She played in the Olympics, but she did not start. Whenever she heard people talk about the Peter principle, rising to your highest level of incompetence, she thought about her experience in field hockey. She had worked and strived and played against the best in the world and found, in the end, that the very best were better than she was. When the team took home a bronze medal, she thought, how appropriate. How doggone appropriate. For favor, she kept it simple. She didn't start.
But you were there.
He was excited by the idea, clearly gripped again by some revived feeling of his own passionate hope for stardom. He was questioning her as an expert, as someone who'd arrived, who could tell him, perhaps, how he had missed the goal. How had she found the fortitude to pay the price? Where did it come from? The drive, the spark? Her responses were laconic. She described practicing until long after dark,